To hear the full episode, become a patron at patreon.com/deathpanelpod.
To do what is necessary would completely undermine this historical necessary division between the deserving and undeserving poor. That, I think, very simply speaks to the contradiction at the heart of psychiatry, which is tasked with, on the one hand, this belief or historical mission that it set for itself of emancipating people, and this other side where madness stands in a concrete material relationship with labor in general and with the other kind of outcasts of labor. So at that point of contradiction, there's a choice that people have to make. Either continue doing what you know is not going to work, or take a kind of radical action and fight.
The Death Panel. Patrons, thank you so much for supporting the show. We could not do any of this without you. To support the show and get access to the second weekly bonus episode and entire back catalog of bonus episodes, become a patron at patreon.com/deathpanelpod. And if you can help us out a little bit more, share the show with your friends, post about your favorite episodes, hold listening and discussion groups, pick up copies of Health Communism and A Short History of Trans Misogyny at your local bookstore, or request them at your local library, and follow us at deathpanel_. So today, I'm really excited to be joined by Sasha Warren to talk about his book called Storming Bedlam, Madness, Utopia, and Revolt that just came out last month from Common Notions Press. Sasha is a writer and independent researcher who focuses on the history of psychiatry and madness. He co-founded the Minnesota chapters of the Hearing Voices Network and the International Society for Psychological and Social Approaches to Psychosis. We met online years ago now and share a mutual affinity for studying patient publications and zines made from within asylums. And Sasha is part of a collective archive and political education project called North American Network of Alternatives to Psychiatry. And his writing is available on his blog called Of Unsound Mind. And of course, as I already mentioned, his first book out now, Storming Bedlam. Sasha, welcome to the Death Panel. It is so great to have you on the show.
Thank you for having me. I'm elated to be here. I'm a longtime listener, and so it's going to be awesome going from just hearing this in my ears to being on it.
Well, I am really excited, and this is really fun for me in so many ways today. First of all, because I loved your book, and what it covers is so relevant to the show, and also as a bonus, really, while we've known each other's work and talked online before, this is the first time that we're actually speaking. And I'm sorry again for missing your DM asking if I would blurb the book, because I would have done so with enthusiasm. Storming Bedlam is definitely one for the real heads. While it might not serve as an introductory text, it is very generous, remarkably comprehensive, just full of well-presented histories. And in the book, you trace some very important moments in the global development of so-called mental health services throughout the 20th century. It's a history of modern psychiatry that really avoids some of the common pitfalls, you know, where people get bogged down in endless methodological debates or the perpetual question of which approach to causality reigns supreme, you know, the endless debate over social bio, biosocial, or biopsychosocial that's like a cul-de-sac where some people who study mental health care provisioning can actually just spend their entire careers comfortably circling round and round. Instead, in this book, you contextualize various international, state, and medical approaches to madness, alienation, and distress in the context of revolution, war, and struggles against scarcity, poverty, and exploitation, with all of the inherent contradictions that arise really highlighted instead of minimized. It's a great intervention, and as I said, so excited to get into it today. But before we get into the book itself, I just want to touch on some of the words that we use that are shared context between us, but which are not terms that everyone is familiar with. Every time we talk about madness, we always get questions about this. And since longtime Death Panel listeners have heard me explain many, many different ways and many times over the years the kind of madness 101, I thought, Sasha, maybe you could start us off by running through how you would explain madness to someone who hasn't heard it used this way before, and just run listeners through your take on the kind of like what we mean when we say madness 101.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I choose to use the word madness generally over and above a term like mental illness, unless I'm specifically talking about a context where it makes sense to talk about mental illness. That's like a clinical context or where the author I'm discussing is using it. But I prefer the term madness generally because, one, there's a kind of historical continuity that gets lost when you solely talk about mental illness. And that's that people have been talking about madness for millennia. We can find a kind of continuous discourse and dialogue with many, many ruptures, but still like an ongoing dialogue spanning the entire world, not just the Western world. There's an extremely long kind of discourse about madness in the Arabic world, for instance. So that's like the first reason is that there's just a longer history. There's more kind of there. You can find notions or like mentions of things that approximate mental illness, maybe even the term mental illness, going back a few hundred years, but it's minuscule in comparison to just this monstrous body of work talking about and thinking about madness, whether in like literature, you know, Shakespeare, the ancient Greeks, playwrights all talked about madness. So that's kind of the first reason is just this historical wealth of material. The second reason is that I think there's a kind of progressive euphemization that happens in mental health services, mm-hmm. where we get further and further from talking about the actual thing that we're talking about. I think a good example, I have two good examples of this from kind of recent experience. One is that Minnesota, the state I live in, I think is kind of the king of this, of doing this kind of thing, where there was a big push to change the language and the law around guardianship. Now, nothing about guardianship materially changed in this whole process. But by the end of it, we now don't call it guardian and ward. We call it guardian and person experiencing guardianship, which is just a step further away from what you're actually talking about. The material relation is exactly the same, but now, you know, experiencing makes it seem like it's this temporal, personal, subjective thing, when actually we're talking about a legal category and something that has changed with the person. And then I was recently at a mental health day on the Hill at the Capitol. I went to kind of just be there. I'd never actually attended one. So I went to go see what, you know, NAMI specifically was pushing because they kind of run the thing. Mm-hmm. And I noticed that like all the speakers no longer even really talk about mental illness. They talk about mental health only. And it's this kind of strange thing where now everybody's saying, I have mental health. I have mental health. And, you know, the weird thing about that is like, conceptually, if you know, accept the idea of mental health and mental illness, everybody has mental health. So it was this strange situation where people were getting up on stage and talking about we need to help people with mental health and all this stuff. And it left feeling extremely confused. And I feel like a lot of the audience had to have been confused. And it's this, yeah, progressive euphemization away from the actual material concrete thing that we're talking about. And I like madness in this sense too, because it's ruder. It's it kind of directly gets to the problem of the situation, which is that madness is this public social problem between people. It's a relationship that needs to be, you know, quote unquote fixed. Where mental illness has this clinical, kind of technical, maybe professional world of imagery that surrounds it. And I feel like it brings to mind maybe the couch, the clinic, medications, things like that, where madness immediately brings to mind this kind of violent rupture between two people in a relationship. So I prefer it in that sense too. And then a third reason, just to kind of note, is that there's now a long tradition going back to the 18th century of people reclaiming various kind of some of these ruder, more direct, maybe even violent terms and using them as a form of self-identification, self-expression. This goes back to like the alleged lunatic society, the, you know, friends of alleged lunatics, to mad pride, mad power, things like that, that came out in the mid 20th century. So, and in Italy, they talk about many texts talk about themselves as like loonies. So there's like a long tradition of people appropriating these terms in the same way that has happened in other struggles.
So well put. I mean, I think that was a fantastic rundown. And the only thing that I would add to that is that it also kind of resists the tendency within psychiatry, which hasn't always been called psychiatry, right? To sort of rebrand and reframe things with new terminology. It's not just like a recent phenomenon that, you know, we're seeing the kind of euphemistic language come into stand where you have mental health standing in for mental illness, which stands in for many other words and names and sort of clinical categories that have been appropriated into common language that have shifted and changed. And madness is a kind of way of rooting against that tendency to quote unquote revolutionize just through mere shifts in language. What I mean, and this is one of the things you trace in the book, is how what we'll see often in these sort of histories of psychiatry or psychiatric and psychological treatment methods, and especially when there's sort of things that are trying to analyze, for example, you know, major changes and sort of that present these accounts of like maybe a past medico-legal discipline that was very barbaric and a modernist sort of future version of the discipline that has sort of moved on beyond all those things. But that frustratingly enough, there is a lot more sort of continuity than a lot of the sort of language games lead us to believe. And I think in some ways, one of the wonderful things that this book does is it not only doesn't engage in those debates, but actually just sort of runs over them. and you know, you walk through so many different shifts, for example, from moral treatment to the antipsychiatrists, right? This is, in theory, each time psychiatry or mental health or mental illness or, you know, alienation, madness, each of these sort of words also often has a relationship to a particular discipline or a particular group of people in a particular method. And madness is really one of the only words within this kind of category of things that we're talking about that actually kind of resists being pinned down to like any one period in time, any one discipline, any one methodology, any one school of thought, any kind of causal narrative. It's as you're saying, this container that allows us to like actually talk about the thing in front of us.
Exactly. That's better than I could have put it.
Well, I mean, and I was really struggling to narrow down what we were going to talk about today because you touch on so much and I wanted to talk about all of it. But after a lot of deliberation, I decided that we'd focus on a few of the sections that deal with anti-asylum movements that are not in the United States, Canada, or the United Kingdom. You know, I reference these histories in passing often on the show. Artie and I give literally like the briefest possible overviews of some of these other movements in the chapter of health communism called CARE. But really only as a way of contextualizing and setting up the milieu of a group that we're sort of writing about in the chapters Care and Cure, the Socialist Patients Collective. So it's kind of about contextualizing the world and the critiques that they're coming up in and that they're sort of coming to their ideas in. So since your book tackles some of these so well, I think today we'll spend a lot of time getting into some of the other anti-asylum movements like in France and Italy that we haven't had a chance to really spend the time with on the show. But first, let's talk about the book as a whole. As I mentioned, Storming Bedlam is a history, right? But I also think it's doing a very important reframe. You know, it's pushing back against this tendency to say that so-called mental illness is caused in totality by any one thing, that this is kind of a war between methods, right, in a very hermetically sealed way. It's also engaging with the ontology of madness, you know, what madness is both as identity or experience, as medical category, as legal category, relative to nation states or health systems. It covers a lot of ground. So this is a kind of difficult task in some ways, but can you just give a brief overview of the book and really sort of centralize what your argument is in Storming Bedlam? And can you talk about what you hope the book can offer people?
Yeah, absolutely. Maybe I'll do this through telling like how the thesis came to be, because it wasn't straightforward and it wasn't my plan to write the book that I ended up writing.
Yeah, I thought that.
I came across kind of the critique of psychiatry in a really roundabout way. I had lots of personal experiences with it, familial experiences, and had like lots of lingering resentments and frustrations, but certainly no put together critique or ideas except for just, you know, kind of raw anger. And then I discovered first the kind of the neurodiversity movement and some critiques from there. And then I think, honestly, I was just reading something and they made me quote Zaz, Thomas Zaz, who I've come to see as an enemy, but at the time was was kind of, at least some of the ideas he was throwing around were pretty revelatory, or at least like the force of his critique really grabbed me. And he's, you know, a Hungarian psychiatrist, moved to the United States, wrote The Myth of Mental Illness, has this really simplistic critique, I think, about what mental illness must be, if it's going to be categorized as a real illness. It has to be like a tissue lesion, more or less, which he says, because they can't discover, we're talking about problems of living. What he does open up, and I critique him pretty viciously in the book, I think probably more than anybody, but what he does open up, or what it opened up for me, I should say, he's certainly not the first to make similar critiques or open up this kind of dialogue, but he did for me. And that was that opening up the question of mental illness at the time to the question of the social, of social relationships with other people, what he called problems of living. And just kind of going down that path, discovering, you know, maybe like researching things that were related to him, kind of discovered the whole anti-psychiatry movement, and was pretty interested or engaged with it for a few years. And then I had an opportunity, or just really wanted to actually figure out how to do kind of basic archival research and find what was going on at the asylums around me, because there's in the Midwest, and I think it's the same in a lot of other parts of the country, there's kind of a regional mythology that arises around the sites of asylums, especially like ghost stories and kind of corny, offensive stuff like that. But there's like a magnetism to these spaces. People are drawn to them. They want to explore them. They want to know what they're all about. And once I started getting into this stuff, I also wanted to just go to the site and see what was going on. What were they now? Some of them you can't visit because they've been converted into prisons. Other ones are like ruinous, you know, falling apart. And then other ones are still operating as psychiatric institutions. And this really fascinated me. And I was wanted to know what was the process that led to this scenario? So I started visiting the local archives here at the Historical Society. And that's where I came across, just by opening box after box, really with no plan, because I didn't know how to do this stuff at the time, found those patient journals that we had shared enthusiasm about. And, you know, this discovering these kind of threw me for a loop a little bit, because in these texts, there is a straightforward kind of critique of the treatment that they're receiving or their conditions of the place. And then there were also some basically just panegyrics and like exuberant expressions of appreciation and things like that. And I did kind of chalk up a lot of it to just, you know, the editors are oftentimes like the superintendent himself, or maybe the head nurse or something like that. And it's like, well, yeah, of course they're writing that because they have to or something. And I think that is the case in a lot of these. However, once I got more deeper into this kind of research, I ended up discovering a lot of the cases that I discuss in the book, international cases. And I did this brief like Zoom kind of presentation series in May 2020. So like, no, not May 2020. It was later in the summer after the uprising, but pretty soon after.
I feel like it was July.
That would be right. That sounds right. I don't have my timeline mixed up.
What is time anyways?
Yes. Once I discovered these groups, you know, and there's like a kind of a resurgence of people talking about these international radical psychiatry and anti-psychiatry. So John Foote put out a book about democratic psychiatry and Franco Basaglia called The Man Who Opened the Asylums, I think. And Camille Ropsis put out Disalienation about institutional psychotherapy, and there's others. There's just kind of a resurgence of works talking about these things. So I had a field day and just like consumed as much of the stuff as I could, and then did this presentation series. From that point, after that, that was kind of the skeleton of the book. And my intention really was just to kind of do an introducing the English language audience to international radical and anti-psychiatry. That really was only my only plan at the time. I didn't have like a strong theoretical thesis, except that I had this kind of vague idea that I was still working out, that psychiatry was a strategic assemblage rather than a narrow clinical field, and that it had this relationship with overturnings and coups d'etats and revolutions, and that it changed and morphed through these historical becomings and historical ruptures. That was like a very not well thought out or detailed thesis that I was kind of running with at the time and was planning to figure out as I went. And I did hold on to a little bit of that, or a lot of it, but I ended up adding a lot of ideas and theses that I had not planned on after I discovered two things in particular. One was I felt compelled to go to maybe more obscure archives, especially in the Northeast, to find things that I just would never have access to here. So I went out to the Northeast to New York City and Amherst, Massachusetts, which have just like large archives of these countercultural anti-psychiatry movements of the 1960s. That's what I was aiming for. And I happened to get like one of those awesome archivists who's just like super excited about everything, and was really excited that some like random guy, not from a university and not a psychiatrist, basically she was very confused of what I was doing there. But she was also really excited, and she pulled like a mountain of books from the Opal, which was the journal of the Utica State Asylum, for the Lunatic Asylum, I think was its name at the time. That was one thing that changed my trajectory and made me kind of rethink certain things. Because I don't know what I was expecting to find when I opened it. This was being written in the mid to late 19th century. And what I ended up finding was like patients who were reflecting very deeply on the relationship between madness, society, and historical change in a way that was extremely elaborate and extremely impressive and just surprising to me to see that kind of, I don't know, that kind of historical theory in what was basically like what considered to be like a patient diversion for writing class or something like that. And the other thing that kind of surprised me in it was the overall extreme exuberance for their treatment that I do not think could be chalked up to just editorial selection, because the editors also included some of the harshest critiques of their treatment that I've ever read in a patient journal like this. So I do think that there was a kind of editorial openness, but the majority of patients were like extremely exuberant about their treatment in a way that kind of shocked me, because they weren't just talking about it as like, I'm getting the help that I need and the doctor's really nice and stuff like that. They were saying like, they're revolutionizing our consciousness and we're becoming different human beings and things like that. This language that I associate much more with maybe the literature of like religious conversion or maybe a mystical experience in mystical like Christian literature or something like that. It was not something I was familiar with reading from case studies and patient accounts and novels about institutionalization and things like that, which are usually pretty drab and slow and, you know, just sad. So that was one thing that really affected me. It left me with a strong feeling for a long time. And then I discovered this book by a psychiatrist I'd never heard of, W.A.F. Brown, who I quote liberally throughout the text, who wrote this text about psychiatric utopia. It's called like What Asylums Were, Are, and Ought to Be, I think, is the full title. And it was a series of lectures that he did in the mid 19th century. And it completely shocked me. The first part completely shocked me of how vicious his critique was of his contemporaries and of the institutional arrangement that existed in the 19th century. I think I say somewhere in the book, like I had found nothing in 1960s and 70s anti-psychiatry to match the level of like vicious, you know, venom that he had for the asylum system as it existed at the time. And then at the end of the text, at the final chapter, the final lecture that he gives, he outlines this vision of utopia that immediately reminded me of socialist utopians like Robert Owen and Fourier, which I'd read sporadically throughout my life. And that just fascinated me. And I kind of went down a path where I ended up discovering, reading through, especially Owen, finding direct references to psychiatrists at his time who were talking about their practice as this utopian practice against the vile, you know, villainy of the madhouse system. And then, you know, Fourier also outlines this really detailed psychological system that kind of mirrors in a lot of ways what I end up calling utopian psychiatrists were outlining. But following that path...
To hear the full episode, become a patron at patreon.com/deathpanelpod. You'll get access to this and the rest of our catalog of patron-only episodes, and be the first to get a new patron episode every Monday when it drops. With love, the Death Panel.